We are speaking with Barry Mandel. He is president and park director of Discovery Green. He was also one of the early activists in Houston's history in the 1980s who responded in numerous ways to the AIDS crisis. He has recently given his life story to the Oral History Project, which is chronicling the history of AIDS in Houston. And we are talking to him about that time. So Barry, while all this was happening, you were also getting involved politically, and you started to work on the campaign of a female candidate named Catherine J. Whitmire. Can you tell us who she was and how you came to be associated with her campaign and what you did?
My political involvement happened before that. Is city council had voted on an equal rights ordinance, and this was, I believe, in like 1984. And it passed. It passed city council. And they went out and collected, Stephen Hoetze once again, went out and collected enough petitions to recall that vote and to put it up for ballot to the local politicians. And it was during that time that I thought, all right, now I've got to do something. I ended up organizing a bar tour for Kathy Whitmire, who was the then mayor, the first female mayor here. We did this, I want to say it was the Saturday night before the election when it went to ballot. Long story short, I think the ballot was on a Saturday, so maybe it was the Friday night before. Long story short, we ended up losing, and it was defeated by 3-1 margin. And I was crushed. I mean, I was just crushed because the venom and the hate that had come out of my hometown was just overwhelming. Well, it didn't stop there. Then Hoetze got a group of folks, including his mother, to run against those politicians, those council members that had voted for this equal rights ordinance. So he ran somebody against Kathy Whitmire and Judson Robinson and Eleanor Tinsley and any of the council members that had voted in favor of this equal rights ordinance. They banded together this group to run against them and went and were as bold as to call themselves the straight slate. Their number one priority was that you knew that they were against an equal rights ordinance, period. And so a friend of mine was a loan executive to Kathy Whitmire, and I called her and I said, hey, I'd really like to get involved in the election now with Kathy's campaign. She's like, great, come and help me with fundraising. Okay. We have our first meeting with the mayor, and it was usually held downstairs at City Hall. There was then a mayor's dining room where her leadership team would all get together, and Barbara, my friend, would go to it to talk about the campaign and the fundraising. And the day before that election, or that meeting rather, Barbara calls me to tell me that she had been diagnosed with breast cancer and that I was going to have to take over fundraising for the campaign.
And you are what, 25 years old, relatively green, political novice, and suddenly you're put in a key position?
Not relatively green, completely green. I'd never raised a dollar for politics. I'd never given a dollar to a politician. And I was supposed to go in and develop a fundraising campaign for the mayor. And it was during that I really kind of, you know, trial by fire, you know, was thrown into it. I would travel with Kathy all of the time at that point. I'd taken a leave of absence from work, and I would travel with her to any of the stops she had to make. And it was on one of those stops that were in the car, and her phone rings, and she turns around to me afterwards, and she goes, you're not going to believe what just happened. And I said, what? She goes, they were interviewing her opponent, a former mayor, Louis Welch, and when the TV reporter says in the lead-in, we'll be talking to former Mayor Welch about how he plans to deal with the AIDS crisis in Houston. He, thinking that the mic was off, says, yeah, I'm going to shoot all the gays. And with that, the mic being live, it gets broadcast across the city. And that Halloween, the big costume were T-shirts that had what looked to be like bullet holes all in them that said, don't shoot Louie. And that was how Kathy ended up winning that election.
But the politics bug had not let you go at that point. You have served for an organization called Annie's List that helps to elect progressive women. You've served on their board of directors statewide. Talk about Annie's List and what it does and why you have been so devoted to it.
it dawned on me a couple of years ago that it just feels like women have more wherewithal to come into a room, to hear both sides of an issue, and to figure out how to meet in the middle on most things. And starting, I guess, with Kathy, but then going on through years and years of other politicians that I have continued to support and admire, electing women, to me, just seems the best chance we have for getting ourselves out of this situation that we're in right now. Annie's list, I was taken by it. They were the first to get Hillary out on the road and at a luncheon to speak after she lost the presidential election. And I have just continued to really do my best to support women in elected office.
And in 2018, didn't Annie's list have a very good year in Texas with helping to foment an 8 or 9 seat gain in the Texas House of Representatives, many of whom were female candidates?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you have a penchant for working with dynamic women. Let's switch back to the 1990s. And why don't you tell me about your involvement on the board of directors of the AIDS Foundation Houston and your work with the then executive director, Sarah Selber?
Sarah and I grew up together and were very, very close friends. And I had served in the early, early days, you know, even when it was the KS AIDS Foundation at the time. And then as we develop into the later 90s, it's now become the AIDS Foundation that is beset by turmoil and seemingly unable to get out of its own way. And I want to say they had 12 executive directors in 11 years, something like that. There was no continuity. It was just a ship that was way off course. And I get a call from Sarah, who was living in, I think at that point she was in Oklahoma City. And she says to me, "Do you know anybody that's on the board at the AIDS Foundation?" And I'm like, "Yeah, why?" She goes, "I've applied to be the executive director." And I'm like, "What for?" She goes, "I think I can make a difference. I really do." I'm like, "Okay." And again, I'm remembering, you know, the 12 executive directors in 11 years, thinking, I don't know why she's doing this. Ultimately, they offer her the job. And we go out and we have breakfast 2 days after that. And I said to her, "What's the first thing you want to do?" She goes, "I need to limit the term of the board members." No, she said to me, "I'm going to either be here for a week or I'm going to be here for years." And I said, What's the first thing you want to do?" She goes, "I need to limit the term of the board members." And I'm like, "Sarah, have a good week because you're done. They're never going to stand for it." I mean, they're never going to stand for it. And long story short, she was there for years and completely transformed that organization.
And she even convinced you to join the board at a certain point, didn't she?
And convinced me to go back and join the board again. Yeah.
During the 1990s, your day job was as executive director of the Houston Theater District, and that was a very productive time for the arts community in terms of responding to the AIDS crisis and trying to raise awareness and build public support for people living with AIDS. Can you talk about some of the initiatives that you remember that the Houston arts community launched that were effective at moving hearts and minds?
It was everything from as simple as making sure that the AIDS walk went through the theater district and that we had a presence there as they crossed over that intersection of Texas and Smith. And then there were just some unbelievable art that was coming out of the arts community, whether it was performing or whether it was visual, that was to empower people, to remember people, to celebrate life. And to keep so many of us that had been in it for so long going. Every arts organization was out there looking for and performing something that had a message of compassion, of love, of sympathy, of sorrow. It was a really engulfing kind of a time to be in the arts and to be gay and to have AIDS and equality and discrimination as important platforms for you to do something about. I was very lucky to be there then with the managing directors that were in place.
Moving forward, you've also been very active with an organization called Undies for Everyone. That's a very cute name, and people may not understand what that means because it sounds like a child's toy. Talk about the work that they do and why you were moved to serve as their chairman of the board.
I'm a speaker on board governance and I guess I would just pull it all under board governance at a Rice nonprofit program that they run for people that see themselves as future executive directors of nonprofits. And they go through a year learning everything from how do you read financials to how do you fundraise to how do you elect a board? How do you manage a board? And so I speak one of the classes every year. And it was at one of those classes that I met a woman named Rabbi Amy Weiss. And she never wanted to be like a pulpit kind of a rabbi, but really more of a social entrepreneur. And realized and found out for those people that are disadvantaged, at the time it was underwear and socks are really clean. Underwear and socks are really hard to come by. And especially the impact that clean underwear have on young kids in school. If you don't have the wherewithal to have extra underwear for a young child, that child can be taken out of class if he or she has an accident and stay out of class for the remainder of the day. Learning only happens in the classroom. And so Amy saw that and put together a program that distributed new underwear to the school nurses. It has developed now to multiple programs that still address school nurses, but that also partner with the food banks, with CPS, a whole array of other service providers that make sure that kids now have a week's worth of clean underwear. And it's now in multiple cities and multiple states. And that's how I got involved, was meeting her at that line class at Rice University. And I was just so taken again by this strong, confident, social entrepreneur woman that when she said, you should come on my board, I couldn't say no. And actually today I'm board chair.
So one of the key themes of your life seems to be service to the community, service to people who were struggling with HIV and AIDS. What inculcated that spirit of service within you?
My father always told us, you watch out for your fellow man. You watch out for your fellow man, you watch out for your fellow woman, and anybody's load that you can lighten, if you have the power to, then it's incumbent upon you to do that. The whole AIDS thing, it's like I couldn't turn myself away from it. I mean, it was killing my friends, and there was no way, given the way that I had been brought up, that I could sit by and not do something.
Those were a long, dark 20 years before medications were developed, the protease inhibitors that would have such a miraculous effect on people who were living with HIV. The struggle was dark and at times overwhelming. What kept you going?
I don't know. I've never really sat and thought about that, Andrew. It's like you couldn't stop. You couldn't stop. And maybe part of it was you just had to take your emotions and your feelings and your grief and set it to the side. You couldn't stop because it wasn't stopping. And I actually was running a group of physicians that were primary providers in HIV care during the time that the protease inhibitors and the cocktail came out. And I guess I am so lucky that I got to see that up close, because it feels much like this vaccine right now with COVID. It felt like all of a sudden after these years of just death. And it wasn't just somebody died. It was usually really painful and really horrible. There was light at the end of the tunnel. People still have issues with getting medications, you know, and there are still people dying of AIDS today. But at least there was something that curbed the numbers at that point. And I was lucky that I got to see it firsthand.
I know that your day job is as president and park director of Discovery Green, and we're moving into a new year. And I know that you are deeply and passionately committed to the work that Discovery Green does. So tell our listeners some of the many activities, many of them free, that they can participate in at Discovery Green in January 2021 and looking forward.
We'll still have our ice rink open, and that'll open through the middle of January. And again, there's a whole group of COVID procedures that, you know, you have to go through. You have to buy your ticket online prior to being there. You have to wear a mask. We take your temperature, all of those kind of safety precautions. It's a much smaller ice, it is a smaller ice rink than it normally is. So that gives us more room to change in the skate changing area. And it's a limited number of people that can be on the ice at any one time. And then we follow that up in the spring with our outdoor roller skating rink. But again, we'll be following the same COVID precautions and procedures for that. And that's during the month of March. And we are pretty much in a wait and see kind of mode as to what we can do and how much we can do for spring and as we get closer to the summer. We right now have in-person exercise classes. And again, we've got the circles on the lawns and you stay within your circle, you know, for people to be safe. So we're waiting to see as the vaccines start to take hold and more in the community start to receive them, how soon we can start regular programming, you know, which is movies or concerts and other exercise classes. We're hoping that we have a whole new playground that's been completed, never opened yet because it was completed in the midst of COVID. And we're hoping that the mayor will lift those restrictions at some point in the spring, as well as on our water features for kids to enjoy. So we really are focusing on just kind of slowly starting to reintroduce in-person and live programming into the park during the spring, and that we will be able to go full out in the fall. We've been doing a whole array of different online programs for people to enjoy. And that's everything, again, from exercise classes to music, concerts, cooking classes that are all available online at Discovery Greens, off Discovery Greens website.
And if you've just joined us, we've been speaking with Barry Mandel. He is president and park director of Discovery Green, Houston's jewel box of a park that is located in downtown Houston near the George R. Brown Convention Center. For more information on their activities, you can go to www.discoverygreen.com. They have an exhibition, Monuments by Craig Walsh, which is on view through January 18th, 2021 at the park. It is free of charge, and the video projections are on display every night from dusk until 10 p.m. Barry has also given his life story to the Oral History Project, which is chronicling the stories of Houston's response to AIDS. And if you would like to read Barry's oral history and to learn more about the work that the Oral History Project is doing, you can go to theoproject.org. Barry, thank you for your four decades of commitment to the city of Houston, for your leadership in an incredibly dark time of the AIDS crisis in the 1980s and the 1990s, and for all that you do to make Discovery Green a destination for all Houstonians, regardless of age, income, or geographic location, to have a place to come and to enjoy and to learn and to grow.
Thank you.